right? There's a winning tradition in the other 21 for the Africans, for the African continent, but it stops there, right? It stops there, and African squad has never won in the World Cup. So what I'm saying is that it's not, it can't be that just individual players don't pan out, because then you would have that in every country, right? You'd have European teams. What I'm thinking, my theory, is that what happens is these players leave.
No, but I'm telling you, wait a second, Jabi, miss, I'm telling you, they don't leave, they don't become, wait, please,
okay.
Because I'm telling you something, one is, when you play, FIFA has a rule where if you represent one country, you cannot come, for example, and play in this World Cup and play for South Africa, and next World Cup you play for Germany. It doesn't happen. Okay?
I'm saying they're younger. I'm wrong then. I must have my
exactly.
Wrong.
You know,
what I'm saying is I'm thinking that this is junior, that these are under 21, so
yeah,
that
I'm
if
trying,
you're 16 and you're on the squad.
Miss, yeah, if you will.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, you're not listening. You're insisting.
I am, but I think I am listening.
You say you don't know. That is what you're saying.
If I can, please,
go ahead.
Let me say this, miss. For example, the player Drogba. Drogba is from
Ivory Coast.
Right.
He goes to France at, I think, 5 years old. He plays in France all this time, but his loyalty is to Africa. So he represents Africa. Eto'o has been in Spain since he was about 14. He chooses not to play for Spain, but to play for Cameroon. So I think the point you're making about attrition as in moving on, it's a question of, do I play for the quote-unquote adopted country, or do I play for the country of my heart?
Exactly.
And in many instances,
in many instances,
what they do is play for the country of their heart. And when we see, for example, a Thierry Henry playing for France, I don't know that it diminishes us as African peoples.
It doesn't
because
at all.
Essentially,
it doesn't at all.
But that is not the point that you're saying. You want to know why it is a team, an African team that wins at the under 17 level, does not win at the adult level.
No, can I interject, please?
Yes, go ahead, Jabi.
Wait a second, miss.
Yeah, what I'm hearing here is that what you just stated, Abdi, and I understand what the sister is trying to. However, there's a distinct difference between an under-20 team and an open team. Now, an open team, there is no restriction in age. So for many countries, say Brazil, for example, they are never often successful in the under-20 tournaments. But they always win and be successful in the senior tournaments, because now you have people who are 17 that can participate in the open tournament as well.
Right.
So many of your juniors are playing in the World Cup.
Right.
You see,
whereas
in Africa, many times the best players that are youths are usually homegrown and are in Africa, where they can amass a team that has been playing together over a longer period of time.
Okay, I see.
Whereas in the other countries, many of their under 20 teams are made up of players that are scattered.
Okay.
You see?
I see. Hapti Selassie?
Yes, Hapti.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah. Hapti. I think what you were saying, which is what I was having a hard time understanding, was that what happens is the players just start stinking. You know, like, they just don't pan out. They're just like prodigies. That's what I was hearing. When I was asking the question, and I heard that from you, and I'm like, well, it can't be that all these players under 21 just start.
No, I think that was because you weren't listening. I was giving that one of the aspects of things. Not that everybody just flops, but we have to go here. And thank you very much for calling.
You're welcome.
Jabi, one love.
Love
okay?
again.
And next week. And to all of you... Thank you for listening. Thanks for participating. Stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. Jim will be followed by Simon Locally doing As I Please. Simon by David Rothenberg with Any Saturday. And following that, it would be Eddie Ellis and the crew with On the Count. You have been listening to Labrish. My name is Haptah Selassie. We'll be back next week with another edition of the program. Labrish is produced by Ian Forrest and is a De Jazz Mac production. Remember to tell the people whom you love that you love them and show affection. With love, we'll find unity and strength. One love, walk good. Football! Mr. Tosh!
Be, yeah, no love at all. There will never be no love at all. I've got to put aside name segregation. I've got to put aside theme organization. I've got to put aside. Be no love at all. I mean, there will never be no love at all. So build our love on one foundation. Come let us build our love on one solid foundation. Got to build our love. Oh, there will never be a single drop of blue. You won't have no freedom, yeah. Got to come together. We are birds of a feather. We got to come together, 'cause we are birds of a feather. Feather, or there will never be, Lord of mercy, no love at all. There will never be, yeah, yeah, no love at all. We also got to realize we are one people, yeah, got to realize that we are one people.
Morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With me this morning, Richard Bowes, Rick Bowes, author of
do, what I do, what I do, da da do, da da do.
Thank you.
of course, two cuts from Duke Ellington. The Mooch was the latter of the two. And before that, It Don't Mean a Thing, if it ain't got that swing, with vocals by Ivy Anderson. Just a couple of incredible pieces of music from history. And before that, the opening of Silent Running. It's the opening of the show. It's not the... Oh, I have to turn off the darn phone. Who's sending me emails at this hour? Anyway, there we go. Silenced now.
Silence of the Lambs.
Yes, exactly. It was, of course, the Space Fleet from the soundtrack of the motion picture Silent Running. And I'm obviously asleep. And in addition, my name is Jim Freund. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction and fantasy and related fields of endeavor. Now, as far as I knew from any schedule that I had been given, this is not a pitching morning for us, except we do what they call pitching to the web. Okay, in other words, we're not going to recite the phone number. We're not going to say to call and pledge. But what we do say is go to the website. You know, if you do it in the, Leo McKern fashion from Help, you know, it's go to the website as he's talking to, he and Eleanor Braun are talking to Ringo, as I recall at that moment. Great moments in cinema, great moments in cinema, at any rate. They're not as good as A Hard Day's Night, but campy.
Amazingly so, yeah.
Yeah. I do enjoy Richard Lester films a great deal. No matter who is the focus. So, let's see. Announcements. This coming Wednesday at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Readings will be the lovely duo of Jack Ketchum, and a grisly horror writer, and he likes it that way, and Scott Edelman, who I guess has had his grisly moments as well. Yes, Rick, you're...
No, I mean, he's pretty much a horror writer at this point.
Scott.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I never thought of him that way.
No, but...
But he's become that.
That is where he came to Earth, yeah.
Yeah. And he, of course, writes a great deal of... nonfiction about the genres, and spent a number of years at Marvel. So he's an interesting...
And was the editor of SF Age.
That's right. Science
Fiction. The only editor, I believe.
Right.
Yeah.
And a good time will be had if you attend. I'm just not running on the automatic that I usually do. It's 85 East 4th Street. This coming Wednesday at, I'll tell you, it's 7:30, because that way I'm sure to get my seat. No, it actually starts at 7, and it does get crowded usually, so we advise that you be there at about 6:30. Now, I probably told you all that we ended the season of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And that's true, except that we have revived it. It will be... Yeah, now there's the movie series. You know, that's an additional thing. And we did Kinzadza last Tuesday, and it was a lot of fun, very bizarre. It's about the third time I've seen that film. And it is a different experience every time. Really... amazing, bizarre, wonderful thing. We did not have a large audience, but boy, it was a loyal audience, including an actress from the film showed up. And, you know, how often do you have, it's obscure here. It's not obscure at all in Russia, but and satellite countries, Kinzadza is rather well known. For those who don't know, it's sort of a Russian absurdist version of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Very Sheckley-esque, movie. So how often do you have, you know, a film like that? And one of the actresses from the film just happens to show up when we have an entire audience of eight. That was pretty cool, actually. And the screening left a little to be desired in terms of the clarity of the video projector. Hopefully this will be worked out over time. The next thing that's going to be showed there is called Star Wreck, W-R-E-C-K. And this is a Finnish obscure movie. It's a, well, obviously.
It's redundant.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, even Swedish movies are well known, but Finnish movies are just, you know, so a Finnish parody of Star Trek, okay? That's basically what you're dealing with here. You know, this is what you get when you get Kinzadza when I'm choosing them and Starwick when John Ordover is choosing them. So, yeah, that's exactly what you would expect. But we, you know, we're going to do a few more films. I would like to do Sita Sings the Blues. I think that I was telling Rick about that. If this is a movie you don't know, go to SitaSingsTheBlues.com and download it. It's a freely available movie. It runs on Channel 13 every so often and at various theaters, and maybe we can do it. Well, you know, anybody can do it. One should. It's available through Creative Commons. So you can just show it, and one should be respectful. But it's a wonderful, wonderful movie. If you haven't seen this, do so. Do so, and then buy some of the stuff that they have on the website. I got myself a Sita Sings the Blues T-shirt, which I'm going to be displaying proudly often. There's actually four or five different styles. I got the phonograph record. Barbara got herself a Sita pin. How do you say it? A cloison? C-L-O-I...
Cloison, yeah. Cloison, yeah.
Yeah, Cloison, yeah. Lovely stuff. So as I was saying, our season is over, except if amazing people become available. Well, such has happened. And so the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings will resume past its season. Its season is being extended for the purposes of featuring, among other people, Paolo Bacigalupi, who won the Nebula Award this year for The Wind-Up Girl?
Right.
Yeah, The Wind-Up Girl, which is a novel. I think of him as a short story writer.
Well, actually, there are aspects of The Wind-Up Girl that are kind of fix-up. I mean, there are a couple of... I don't know if anyone wants me to say this, but there are a couple of short stories. I'm going to out Paolo Bacigalupi as a fix-up artist. There are a couple of the short stories that are incorporated into the book.
That would be a great title, The Fix-Up Artist.
You're right. There was one, The Pick-Up Artist, but
right.
Yeah, this would be The Fix-Up Artist. Yeah.
That would be The Pick-Up Artist. Had nothing to do with...
Famous fix-up artists of history.
Yes. So that will be on July. Let me get my calendar right here, and that far I'm actually prepared. Yes, July 6th. Paolo, by the way, will be the guest on this program on July 3rd. Next week, our guest will be Aliyah Dawn Johnson. Not sure about the weeks, the intervening week. That would be the. The 26th. That's still a quick fix, although I have an idea what that will be. Then on July 10th, I will not be here. Simon Lokley will fill in. I haven't told Simon yet. I have to tell him that because I will be away at ReaderCon. Then on the 24th, Mary Kay Hobson will join us. On the 31st, David J. Williams. Talking about his the third novel in his trilogy, The Machinery of Light. And, we're actually booked August 7th, Altered Fluid. en masse.
Is there enough room in this?
This is our sixth show.
Yeah.
With the whole group. And this is my version of reality show, as it were, where the whole group comes in, one of them reads a short story, and the rest of them critique it. And the reader this time will be Kay Tempest Bradford. So get ready for an interesting morning. So let's see. The next booking after that is all the way into September, Brenda Clough. So I'm sure we will have others, but it's going to be a cool summer here on Hour of the Wolf. Let me not phrase that at all. Let's just drop. It's going to be a lot of good radio shows over the summer, including this morning. Now, you see, I didn't pull up your bio or anything. I ought to know it by heart, shouldn't I?
I don't, so I don't see why you would.
Oh, okay. Well, let's see if we can eck it out ourselves. My guest is Richard Bowes, B-O-W-E-S. More familiarly known as Rick. And you were a Nebula nominee this year.
I'm a Nebula nominee every year. I've never won a Nebula, but I'm always a Nebula nominee. I think it's my sixth.
Is that your sixth nomination?
Sixth nomination, yes.
Wow.
Other things I win, but Nebulas I just get nominated.
Yeah, you've gotten... Is it two World Fantasy Awards?
Two World Fantasy Awards, yes. And I have them... I have the... Lovecraft busts, beautifully dressed. One of them,
yes, they are.
One of them has a fright wig, and the other is wearing a World War I aviator helmet and goggles.
Quite becoming, actually.
He's the ugliest person who ever lived, and that is one extremely ugly trophy. But with work, it can be turned into an adornment.
It's ugly in an endearing manner. You know, it's sort of a Gayne Wilson-ish kind of a...
Oh, I don't know.
I don't have to live in the house with...
Right. They need something. I mean, waking up and seeing those is like really pretty frightening.
Yeah, and the Lambda Award?
I won a Lambda Award, yes, for Minions of the Moon. And what else have I won? I won the International Horror Guild Award. And
that's
I won
right.
that for There's a Hole in the City. And I won...
Which attentive listeners will have heard.
Which attentive listeners, people with better memories than mine, will remember. And I also won the Million Writers Award for There's a Hole in the City. And the Million Writers Award is interesting. It's not a genre award. I mean, it's available to... It's best... story published online in the prior year, and it's one
originally
of the,
online.
Originally online, yes. Thank you. And it's one of the very few awards where genre and non-genre works compete, and the genre works win on occasion.
Yeah.
Depending on
sometimes if they have help, but I got out of it.
Sometimes it's campaigning. I was raised in. Politics, and yes, I understand.
Boston politics.
Boston
yeah.
politics, and yes, I do like a good, dirty campaign.
So books currently in print?
God, I don't know.
From the Galaxies of the Time Rangers?
From the Files of the
Time Rangers? From the
Files of the Time Rangers?
I'm really asleep.
Yeah, you're asleep at the switch here.
Yeah.
From the Files of the Time Rangers is still available. Streetcar Dreams and Other Midnight Fancies, which came out from PS in England, is still available. Has a very nice introduction by Jeff Ford. Matter of fact, from the Files of the Time Rangers has a very nice, more nice than it deserved, introduction from Cage Baker, who passed away earlier this year. Let's see, those are the two that are in print, but, you know, through the wonders of Amazon and so on, all of the earlier stuff,
Minions
of the Moon is certainly available, and even I began in this field in the early 80s doing novels. The first three pieces of speculative fiction I wrote were novels, and all of them got bought, and all of them got published. And I realized, well, there's nothing really to this, you know. You just and then, I, Then the paperback original market collapsed, and I began writing short stories.
Yeah, what they were calling the midlist prices.
The midlist crisis. Well, yeah. Everyone agreed that too many paperback books were being published, but nobody thought that theirs were the ones that were too many. So
right.
That was the difficulty.
Yeah. Now, you wanted to read a piece early on, befitting the time of year, I suppose.
Yeah, it's Gay Pride weekend isn't for another, I can't even remember if it's a weekend or two weekends from now, but I did this piece last year. Matt Chaney, who has a online blog, like there's any other kind of blog, has a blog called The Mumpsimus, asked me to do a piece last year for the 40th anniversary of the Stonewall riots. And I came up with this thing, which got a lot of play last year, and which is going to be reprinted in Year's Best Gay Short Stories, or Year's Best Gay Stories, I forget which, what the title is. But
that's cool. Well,
yes, it is. I'm
very
happy.
Who's the editor of that?
Steve Berman.
Ah, okay.
So
it's not a genre collection, but it has a genre-based editor.
It has a genre-based editor, and there are at times genre works in there. Last year, it had AKA St. Mark's Place was in there. Or was AKA St. Mark's Place in Wild Stories? And was it, in fact, was it If Angels Fight that was in there? God knows. If Angels Fight was in five different anthologies, and I can't remember which. But anyway, this thing is called In History's Vicinity, and may I read it at this point? Okay. In History's Vicinity. It's odd to be old enough to remember history. The Stonewall Riot always makes me feel like a citizen of Concord, awakened by musket fire on that crisp April morning and wondering what the commotion was. In 1965, when I was 21, I came into Manhattan from college on Friday afternoons to see a psychiatrist on the Upper East Side. On my way back to Penn Station in Long Island, I'd walk down Third Avenue. In the East 60s, guys stood casually on street corners, paused significantly in doorways, gave sidelong glances, all very discreet. Eyes tracked me from the windows of the bird bars, the blue parrot, the golden pheasant, the swan. In those bars, Piaf sang on the jukebox. Men in suits sat at the bar. The legal drinking age was 18. But in straight places, I still got carded and sometimes was refused service. Gay bars were much less fussy, and the patrons could be generous. The first gay bar I ever went to was one in Boston called something like the Teacup or the Sugar Bowl. I was 16, and the drinking age there was 21. They wouldn't serve me, but didn't care if guys gave me their drinks. Down the avenue from the bars, at 53rd and 3rd, was a world-famous chicken run. Young boys stood in the cold in sneakers and thin jackets, waited under awnings, stared out the windows of seedy coffee shops, and knew just who I was. Those bars, those coffee shops, were criminal enterprises, subject to police raids and being shut down. The men cruising and boys loitering could be arrested on a whim. Serving minors, serving as a place where minors could be had for cash, was no bigger a crime than catering to a gay clientele. Matt Crowley's The Boys in the Band was the first American play to deal overtly with the lives of the kind of men who drank in the bird bars. It opened on April 15th, 1968. By the time the movie came out in 1970, its world of gay self-hatred and closeted sex looked like a period piece. Between the play and the movie's openings, the Stonewall riot had occurred. If I'd known the Stonewall was going to become an historic site, I'd have paid more attention. In fact, it was one bar among many. Gay kids poured into Greenwich Village from all over the city, the country, the world. The nation was all on fire, and every oppression but ours got protested. The Stonewall Bar was badly ventilated, crowded and filthy. The toilets were an abomination. The bartenders were hostile, and the drinks were watered. But that was true in all the village gay bars. Manhattan ran on methadrin, and speed was easily obtained there. The drags danced like furies. The crowd was very young. The scent was beer, sweat, amyl nitrate, and cheap cologne. My grandfather from Ireland used to say that if every man who boasted he'd fought in the Easter Rising of 1916 had actually stood at the Dublin post office, James Connolly and Patrick Pearse would be sitting in Buckingham Palace at the moment he spoke. In my case, around 3 o'clock on that famous Saturday morning, I was walking down St. Mark's Place with Alan, a guy I'd recently met. A kid we both knew rushed up and gave us a garbled story about the Stonewall. That's when we became aware of distant sirens. In that time and place, civil disturbances were what bullfights were to Hemingway's Madrid, and we were all aficionados. The kid ran off to spread the news. Alan and I headed west, crossed Astor Place, and went down 8th Street, which was still the heart of the village. The book and music stores were dark, but the bars were just closing. The after-hour clubs were opening. The street was full of people, all looking west. Near the corner of 6th Avenue was what we recognized as the rear area of a riot. In the doorway of the Nathans, a blonde kid in short shorts and mascara held a bloody towel to his forehead, and a friend held him. From the upper floors of the massive, darkened Women's House of Detention across the avenue, some inmates were yelling, "The bloody pigs are killing all the faggots." Police cars with flashing cherry tops barred the way. All along 6th Avenue, firemen hosed down piles of burning trash. Paddy wagons and tactical patrol buses were parked too deep, and the riot cops were angrier than I ever saw them. Here, coherent memory breaks down. From Sheridan Square, I looked down Christopher Street and caught a glimpse of the front of the Stonewall Bar. Broken glass was everywhere. A car had been turned on its side. The riot had broken down into guerrilla tactics, roving bands of kids chanting slogans, burning trash. That weekend, I saw a cop smash his club across the back of a guy who I think was just coming home with groceries. I heard people shouting from their windows for the cops to go away. By Monday, it was over. But very shortly, events in this tumultuous city, in that time of war and turmoil, began to be defined as having happened before Stonewall or after. And it was kids, like the ones on 53rd and 3rd, not the suit Johns in their uptown bars, who had given us those nights. Men with powdered hair and silk breeches could have signed declarations and petitions to King George forever. But on that Concord morning, it was men and women, not the most attractive or socially poised, not with the purest of motives of the loftiest of intents, people like me, and perhaps like you, who found themselves pushed, one unendurable time too many.
Well, that's evocative.
Well, you know, when I sat down, you know, was asked to write about Stonewall, and I realized, well, you know, I wasn't actually in the riots. But, and the first part of the piece is actually a short, I also use in a short story that I was writing at the time last year that I did this for Matt. It's easy at this point to forget just what that was like. At that point, just what New York was like, what New York gay life was like. The fact that in some ways things were just overtly there. The fact that there could be a chicken run, that, you know, underage boys could be picked up on a vast swath of Lexington Avenue and Third Avenue.
Yeah.
That would be impossible at this point.
And a lot of them hung out at WBAI when they weren't there.
Yes. So, well, you know, so they had to sit down. It was hard. It's hard to find a place to sit when you were, you know,
when you were
on the street.
That was how I knew the cultures. I wasn't a part of that culture, but I think I knew everybody in it. or at least a whole bunch of people, well, because a lot of them came to the station. It was a heady time.
Yes, well, some of them. One of the things about an enterprise like that is that you need a constant supply of new members. But it was the
they grow up, yes.
Right? They grow up or they come to their senses.
Right.
Yeah, and the bird bars themselves were amazing. All of those bars along Third Avenue were. It's hard to say a gay. I suppose you weren't closeted if you were in a gay bar, but if you just walked in, you wouldn't really be able to tell that it was a gay bar most of the time. There would be very little, would have been very little there. Now, downtown, it was different. I mean, there was no doubt at all.
Yeah, that,
the Stonewall was a gay bar. But these were, you know, a lot of the gay bars were really dreadsome places. It was a criminal enterprise. The only people who opened gay bars were criminals. It was mafia-controlled. And the staffs of these places were openly homophobic. It was...
Really?
Yes. There were, more often than not, yes. These were people who, you know, even if they were gay, weren't showing it. The doormen were abusive. The one at the Stonewall, as I recall, was not so bad. But on the whole, yeah, they were the bars, the gay baths. The doormen would be nasty. The bartenders, I mean, they were disgusting places. The Stonewall had no running water. I didn't realize that until later, and the glasses were washed by putting them in a tub under the thing. You know, they put them in the tub and move them around a little bit, and then you know, use them for another patron. It was a simpler time, but yeah. You know, places that, you know, nobody would go at this point. I mean, the most disgusting bars in Manhattan at this moment are nowhere near what, what gay bars, especially gay bars aimed at younger clientele in the Village were like.
I'm not laughing at that. I'm just comparison, the imagery.
Yeah. And the Stonewall was, I mean, it was a disgusting place. I was there every night. No, it was, you know, in retrospect, it was horrendous. But from that did come this resistance. And it seems like little or nothing at this point. One of the things about it that was fascinating and that I only really learned about later was that, I mean, the Charles Street police station was in a police car a couple of minutes away from the Stonewall. And yet the police were trapped inside the Stonewall. They went in, they raided the place, everybody, a crowd formed outside. The cops were trapped inside, and this went on for 15 or 20 minutes at least. The resentment, and there was always a resentment between ordinary cops, between the precinct police and the vice squad. The vice squad did the raids. The precinct police were the ones who allowed these places to stay open. Mm-hmm. And there was a constant friction between them. The police had a very low opinion of the vice squad. You know, these were especially the ones engaged in anti-gay stuff. Not that the cops liked gays, but that, you know, people who wandered around pretending to be gay so they could arrest people who made passes at them were kind of, you know, they were sort of suspect. But also on a basic level, the precinct was where the bribes got paid. To keep the bars open. So the story was that the cops at Charles Street took their own good time about getting a rescue mission together. And it was only when police began showing up from other places, that they came down in numbers and chased the rioters away from the front of the Stonewall. Under normal circumstances, I mean, one is sure that the cops trapped inside were sending out officers in danger messages, which normally would galvanize, you know, every policeman on the Eastern Seaboard, basically. And that delay was what really enabled the thing to get started. After that, I mean, people in New York were riot experienced. I mean, riots were almost, as I said, in this, you know, a form of entertainment practically. And that went on for the rest of the weekend. I mean, there were disturbances in the neighborhood. The other thing that happened that I remember was that the neighborhood itself was not backing the police. That even in 1969 in Greenwich Village, you know, the ordinary inhabitants of the village, and it was still largely a working class neighborhood at that point. I mean, the last of the docks on the Hudson River had closed only a few years before, and it was, you know, still had aspects of a waterfront neighborhood. These were not, on the whole, sophisticated people, but they, you know, the gay couple down the hall from them were...
They lived in a bohemian neighborhood, one that had classically always been that.
Had been certainly for many years. And, you know, they weren't buying, you know, the absolute horror. And also the police, you know, were a disturbance in and of themselves. I mean, it made life very difficult. I mean, the cops were a bigger pain in the behind than the rioters were at that point. But yes, there definitely was that, you know, elderly Italian ladies yelling at the police that they should be ashamed and go off and, you know, arrest bank robbers or something.
Yeah.
It was an amazing change. And as I say, when Boys in the Band, the movie Boys in the Band came out, and I had seen the stage play.
Mm-hmm.
A few months into its run, and one of the things about it was that the entire audience could have gotten up on the stage and performed. I mean, there was absolutely no break between audience and actors. By the time the movie opened, which was like 2 years later, or maybe a little more, but not much more, it really did seem like a period piece. I mean, that... That it was...
It was a moment locked in time when that play came out.
And, it definitely,
and yet it resounds today.
I haven't seen a revival of it. There was one that was put on, which sounded fascinating, and I wanted to see, but I didn't. It was put on over in Chelsea late last year or early this year. I can't remember which. In which it was done in a penthouse apartment. And the audience sat around on the furniture, and the audience was of necessity rather small. I think it was like 70 people at a performance. And the actors just came in and interacted. You did not get to see all the actors at every moment. I mean, there would be lines that you could only hear because they were taking place in the next room or something. And that was supposed to be a very successful revival.
Yeah, I saw a fascinating... show on either CUNY or maybe Channel 1, New York 1 News, some place where they actually discussed theater, where they did a half hour or an hour show of the whatever anniversary it was of Boys in the Band and the surviving cast members and... Going through detail one by one, what happened to every actor in the show and every facet of the show was a fascinating look.
Yeah, it...
At theater, at gay culture, at New York.
Right. All the actors in the original production, I don't think were gay. Cliff Gorman, who played the queeniest of the characters, I believe, identifies as straight, but certainly a lot of them were gay.
Went on to do Lenny, right?
He did. He went on to do Lenny. He went on to play the bar owner in the really very bad De Niro version of Night in the City.
Mm.
Had a good career. But Yeah, a few of them died in the AIDS crisis. Carley did other plays. Matt Carley did other plays. Breeze from the Gulf is I've only read it. I've never seen it performed, but it was a strong play, and it's the character Michael, the host of Boys in the Band. It's his childhood.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed, I know whether it's a practicable play, I mean, there are plays that you read and you say, this is terrific, and then you see somebody try to put them on and you realize, oh no, that just doesn't work at all. It may have that, but I don't think so. It's very Tennessee Williams-y. And I think he has...
That seems apropos. No,
right.
Knowing only the one play of his, and yet when you say very Tennessee Williams-y, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
He did... I think that there is something by him, a new play by him, but definitely that was... I mean, Boys in the Band was his success. But yeah, things did change. It wasn't so much that... I think with all change, it was stuff that people really had felt. I mean, by 1969, I mean, there were many parts of, you know, society where gays were, you know, if not accepted, I mean, just, you know, were there. Things had progressed beyond what they had been like in the 50s. I mean, I do remember the 50s, and that was awful. I assume the 40s and the 30s had, in their own ways, been more awful than the 50s. But yes, this is what we celebrate. And it kind of gets lost. It's sort of the gay pride parades at this point remind me of the St. Patrick's Day parades, you know, in which originally St. Patrick's Day parades were showing the city that there were plenty of Irish people and that unless, you know, some attention was paid to them, they could really cause a lot of trouble. I mean, that was what it was all about. And now it's, you know, little plastic hats and, you know, it's really a much different
thing.
Green
beer, yeah.
Green beer, and it has lost that impetus entirely. But it came out of, really, out of protest and out of being not even an oppressed minority. I think they were probably an oppressed majority at that point, or felt they were oppressed anyway. And like that, so.
Certainly,
and this has nothing to do with science fiction or speculative fiction at all.
That has a lot to do with WBAI.
Has a lot to do with WBAI, yes, that's true.
And certainly the culture that was here. I'm the first person who I worked for, more or less, when I got out of just taking phone calls for pledgers during fundraising drives, was Baird Searles.
Right.
And Baird did the very first radio program, any kind of electronic broadcast for any gay community.
Right.
And he wasn't just a guest on a show where they would actually allow a homosexual.
Right. If it was on TV, he wore a hood over his face so that nobody would identify him.
Yeah, this was an open show, 1963, called The New Symposium. I only began here in 67, but in 1963 he did a show here called The New Symposium, a program right. by and for the homosexual community, as he said on the show.
Yes, pronouncing it that way.
Yes, he certainly did.
I remember that show, actually.
Fabulous voice of his. He and Martin Last. Martin died about 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Compared to about 15
I remember
years
they had that science fiction bookstore on... Abingdon Square.
Well, of course.
And
I was the stock boy. And
well,
Beth Meacham was the cashier.
Yes, it was an all-star cast.
Yes, we were.
I remember going in there once. It was, you know, later. It must have been like 1970, 71. And Baird Searles was there at the behind the counter, which was kind of unusual, usually.
Yeah, I was going to say
Martin
a rare usually, moment,
right.
because usually he
was. But he
just
was the only one.
The peacock.
Right, he
the
seemed.
Place,
he seemed to be the only one there. And these two kids from the neighborhood came in, and what they were doing, they had their milk money, and they were planning to buy a Dungeons and Dragons supplement with this. And Baird Searles was shocked and did not allow them to buy the things. Said, no, your mothers gave you that money. And he sent them about their business. And why aren't you in school? And I thought to myself, this is really not a way to make money. I mean,
no, but I think that was a secondary concern to bear.
Obviously, I great moments though in American commerce. No, I will not sell this to you.
That sounds right. Yeah. Yeah. If he would get into an argument about a particular writer or something like that. But Bay was an amazing person. But
Very nice man.
It seems to me, now, of course, my memory is always faulty. I don't think the store opened until about 70. Because he left BAI. He left BAI as the drama.
It may have been later.
And then immediately opened the store.
It may have been later than 71. I truly don't remember that.
Yeah, that would probably.
The only thing I do remember is his adamant refusal to take the kids' milk money.
Yeah, he would walk around in sort of a silver lamé spaceman's outfit.
That he was wearing. Yeah,
that went down to the crotch.
Right, that I remember he was wearing. But
oh my God.
But usually there was somebody there.
And bearing in mind that this is the first person who I worked for at WBAI, and people were saying, oh, you know, culture is starting to become openly gay. And you know, here was, I was, what, 15, 16 years old, and I'm saying, when wasn't it? I mean, the people who I met through Baird who were working at WBAI or working for him hanging around were Chip Delaney, Thomas M. Dish, Theodore Sturgeon, who wasn't openly gay but had
omnivorous.
Omnivorous.
Yeah.
I'm in touch with his daughter nowadays, by the way. She will be at ReaderCon, Noelle Sturgeon, and there's going to be a marathon reading of his works. I'm going to get to be, John Kessel. I'm following John Kessel or something like that. And everybody's going to take a turn.
Reading the works of Sturgeon. Well, yeah. That will certainly.
I think the last book of the complete Theodore Sturgeon is just coming out, that series that Paul Williams has started.
Yeah, that's right.
And is celebrating that. And so I'm talking to Ms. Sturgeon, Noelle Sturgeon, through email. About maybe, you know, doing something here in WBAI. That would be very cool.
I met him, but he was very late. It was very late in his career, and he seemed like a nice man.
He was a lovely man.
Yeah.
I remember meeting him a couple of times at WBAI, and he was guest of honor at Lunacon in 1971, and I got to spend some time with him there. It was, he was neat, and he was one of my favorite writers.
Yes.
He was certainly around in those days, and omnivorous is probably, he was, if nothing else, very, very open about the cultures that we had here at WBAI. So when you say, no, this doesn't have a lot to do with science fiction, well, it didn't. It did insofar as science fiction, which was very conservative culture.
Very conservative indeed, yes. And given the number of its participants who were gay, a remarkably straight culture.
Yeah, yeah. Outside of certain individuals.
Very much. The times I met Arthur C. Clarke, it was not in a science fiction setting.
Ah!
To put it,
okay.
And I wasn't particularly into science fiction at that point, but I certainly had read, I'd read Childhood's End by the time we met.
Pretty much everybody had.
Right. Well, no, I mean, there were many people that didn't read any science fiction at all, but
yeah, but at that point, people New 2001, A Space Odyssey.
And no, that hadn't occurred yet.
Oh, so this is before 67.
That was before, yeah. That, I think, was in The Offing, although I may be writing that in. No, he was.
Okay.
I think that was
why. It's after 2001 that people started really reading Childhood's End.
Right.
Although it was a college campus favorite.
It was, yes. It was around, but
somewhere below Dune and Lord of the Rings, but
right, and became, was around before them also.
Yeah,
well, not before Lord of the Rings, but before its ascendancy. But I think he may have been in the United States, something to do with the writing of 2001. That may have been why he was here. But
that was done in England. 2001.
It was, but there was some reason for his being here.
And the studios were here, but even then, MGM's.
I don't know. I have no idea. I have no idea why he was in the Chelsea Hotel, but he was in the Chelsea Hotel.
Yeah, I think he just came here a lot, and no doubt his editors were here. So yes, and also the Chelsea Hotel is a good place to.
Chelsea.
Survey the neighborhood.
The neighborhood, yes, if you were interested in sociology. And the Chelsea Hotel at that point was...
Speaking of Tennessee Williams,
yeah. It's the only hotel in the world that's plaques in the front of the famous people who died there. Dylan Thomas. Dylan Thomas, Brendan Behan.
I think they still...
Sid and Nancy, I noticed, they don't mention that.
No,
that isn't in there. No,
but Oscar Wilde's hotel room in Paris, I think, is fairly popular, isn't it?
Well, the one that should be remembered is the one he was in the Cadogan Hotel there, where he was arrested, but I'm not sure that that's standing at this point.
Ah. So we should reintroduce the show and tell people that you're tuned to I should get on mic first and tell people that you're tuned to WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM and at WBAI.org. I did mention that while the fundraising drive is not active on the overnights and we are all doing our shows, nevertheless, we are supposed to pitch to the web. So let me just do that for a moment. Pardon me. And what that basically means is, as you can hear, if you are not aware, we are not your standard, typical, normal radio station. In some ways, we're not even your typical abnormal radio station. We are a unique. And there's a phrase I picked up from George Alec Effinger. That we are a unique. I always like that. And it certainly does apply here, I think, to this program and lo, to WBAI in so many ways. And we are deserving of survival, damn it. We are deserving of being able to find our way through the second decade of the 21st century and beyond. And in order to do that, we have to keep the premise that Pacifica Radio developed, which is listener sponsorship, was invented, or conceived, I should say, by Lewis Hill, who founded the Pacifica Foundation in the late 40s. And we are the New York arm of that, along with KPFA. KPFK is our LA station. KPFA is the one that started it all, the pilot station. We were the third. There are two others, and there are a number of affiliates. In order to survive, we need your support. We need your help. So in order to do that, log in, sign on, or do whatever it takes to get to the website at WBAI.org. That's spelt WBAI.org. WBAI is in We Beg at Intervals, although I would think incessantly maybe replacing the interval part. But it's, three times a year, each time being 4 months. But, you know, there you have it. And it is right now, as always, there's always a critical moment of survival. Well, I'm not going to fully say that. I think that we're in far better shape than we were a couple of years ago, or even perhaps a year ago. We are hardly out of the woods yet. And we still need to assure that we have your support in order to survive. So log in. Go to WBAI.org. And when you do that, let them know that it is Hour of the Wolf that you that caused you to put in that pledge, because, well, it matters. It matters when they take a look at the logs, when they take a look at who raised money and who didn't. If nothing else, it will definitely impact who is on during the fundraising drives and who gets bumped. And it may have ramifications beyond. So please, make that pledge. Log in to WBAI.org and make a pledge. So, as I said, this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me is Richard Bowes. And having said that, I think we're going to take a cut of music and then discuss venues. Does that sound about right?
That sounds perfectly okay.
Okay, good. Now, I know I'm going to be playing 20s jazz next week with Elia Don Johnson here. So, let's see. I'll choose something different. Of course, I hadn't started doing that. Oh, and don't even have the directory up. I just closed that portion. So, bear with me. I think something folky will do for the moment. But, okay, is audio, music. Here we go. There's some music, and there's... I notice I also have a directory here called... How about some Finian's Rainbow?
Why not?
Do you have a preferred song?
How about When the Idle Pour?
Right after pitching. What a good... it ain't going to be the great come and get a day here at WBAI, but...
well, that's a good one also.
But... yes, but we'll start with When the Idle Pour, a wonderful song. So we'll be back in just a few minutes.
They're here! They're here! The Bucks from Shears and Robust!
Those are the angels who live in Fairyland!
Come on, Diana!
It's here! It's here! The great come and get it day! Everything we ordered from Shears and Robust! Idle poor become the idle rich. You'll never know just who is who or who is which. Won't it be rich when everyone's poor relative becomes a rocker fellative and palms no longer itch? What a switch!
Jones is from your rafters.
Let's toast the day
The day we drink that drinky up, but with the little pinky up.
The day on which the idle poor become the idle rich.
When a rich man doesn't want to work, he's a bon vivant.
Yes, he's a bon vivant.
But when a poor man doesn't want to work, he's a loafer, he's a lounger, he's a lazy good for nothing.
He's a jerk.
When a rich man loses on a horse, isn't he the sport?
Oh, isn't he the sport?
But when a poor man loses on a horse, he's a gambler, he's a spender, he's a lowlife, he's a reason for divorce.
When a rich man chases after dames, he's a man about town, a man about town. But when a poor man chases after dames,
he's a bounder,
he's a rounder,
he's a rotter,
and a lot of dirty names.
Idle rich.
You'll never know just who is who or who is which.
No one will see the Irish or the Slav in you, for when you're on Park Avenue, Cornelius and Mike look alike.
When poor Tweedledum is rich Tweedledee,
this discrimination will no longer be.
When we're in the dough and off of the nut,
you won't know your banker from your butler.
Let's make the switch. With just a few annuities, we'll hide those incongruities in cloaks from Abercrombie Fitch.
Sort of grandish sweeps my soul. When thou art near, my heart feels so sugar candish, my head feels so ginger beer. Something so darish, so I don't care-ish, stirs me from limb to limb. It's so terrific, magnific, delish, to have such an amorish, glamorish dish. We could be oh so bright and groomish, skies could be so bluish blue, life could be so loving bloomish, if my ishes could come true.
I'm so cherché la femme.
Why should I vanquish, relinquish, resist, when I simply relish this hellish condition?
I might be mannishish or mouseish, I might be a fowl or fish, but with thee I'm Eisenhowish. Please accept my proposition.
You're under my skinish, so please be givinish, or it's the beginnish of the finish of me.
The 2010 production of Finian's Rainbow, actually, I mean, opened in 2009, but it was in the 2010 right. season. Nominated for a Tony Award. It won't win, but nominated for the Tony Award, being presented tomorrow night as Best Revival. I think that's the hottest area, probably the only area outside of the production of Fences and a couple of other things, wasn't particularly strong. You went to more theater than I. What did you think of the year?
I didn't actually go this year that... I'm sorry. I didn't actually go this year that much.
Mm.
And I don't think I saw very few of the things that were nominated in any category.
Yeah, about the only two things that I saw on Broadway were two of the nominees, was A Little Night Music and This Finian's Rainbow. And I loved both of them, but This Finian's Rainbow was... Well,
it's also more unusual. I mean, night music has been, you know, put on by opera companies. All kinds
yeah.
of things have happened with it. Finian's Rainbow really... hasn't. I mean, given that it's a very strong score and
fabulous score,
right? It was a
Yip Harburg and
yeah.
Barton
Lane,
yeah,
who was considered the heir to Gershwin, but for various reasons, never really fulfilled that. He may have had some kind of problems or something. I don't know what it was, but he never, in the end, did that many shows.
Yeah. And Harburg's lyrics are just wonderful for this. Very Gilbert and Sullivan.
Very much, very much. And I believe that was the last success that Yip Harburg had.
Probably. On that, yeah, because he had a few dud shows after that.
After that, Flahooey. And, you know.
I never saw Flahooey.
No one saw Flahooey. It was.
Yeah. But at any rate, that's the cast recording from the most recent production. And again, I suppose I'll watch the Tony Awards tomorrow night. I usually do every year. But let me just remind people, this is WBAI New York at 99.5 FM and at WBAI.org, either stream.wbai.org or archive. WBAI.org if you're a retroactive listener, shall we say. And the program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me, Richard Bose, who is going to read... Are you ready? Are you?
I am as ready as can be.
Okay, well, this is a story that Rick read at the KGB Fantastic Fiction series a couple of months ago. And it went over wonderfully. It's not exactly a knee-slapping story, but for you, it's broad comedy.
Well,
is that fair?
I guess, since I don't... right, by the standards of my stories.
Laughing.
Yeah, I had the audience laughing. Well, it was one of those things I was really, truly preaching to the choir here, because, well, you'll see in the story. It's... yes, it's about the audience, basically, and it's called Venues, and it will appear in the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. I'm not sure when, but probably in the not-too-distant future. "Why are you in there?" asked the reporter for New York One Cable News, and stuck her microphone between the bars of the writer's cage. The art zoo was a PR stunt, intended to draw attention to the plight of poor artists. I thought the idea was amusing until the gate slammed behind me, the lock clicked, and I couldn't get out. Rather than tell the reporter that, I said, "Everything in the arts depends on getting shown, getting heard, getting read, getting seen, but mostly getting attention. The news media is our oxygen. Later, I saw myself on television. My hair was wild. My hands clutched the bars of the cage in which I was locked. Behind me clustered writers in their work clothes, pajamas, shoddy underwear, quietly seething that a lowly spec fiction writer was soaking up camera time. All around Tompkins Square in the East Village were cages full of dancers, painters, actors, musicians, and writers, at work or frantically trying to sell their work. The dancers and musicians drew the crowds. Painters and actors had a certain following. The writers, a motley crew, were not popular favorites. Most sat at keyboards and sometimes, out of boredom, leapt up to try and snare the prop publishing contracts that hung just out of reach on trees. This began as an act, but became more real as the day progressed. They really seemed to want those prop contracts. One inmate, who looked at first like a child in an old slouch hat, was, I saw on second glance, an adult, aged and sardonic, with a face like a wise old monkey's. He seemed familiar, but I couldn't quite remember why. When I asked later on, nobody remembered him. I only spent a late afternoon and evening on display, but the time served proved productive. I was on TV for about 20 seconds, and apparently everyone in the city saw me. When I got out, a couple of editors asked if I had stories to send them. Andre, a hot, youngish guy from my yoga class in the gym, whom I'd noticed but never spoken to, mentioned that he'd seen me. "What was it like?" he asked. I was about to say something about the publicity aspect when I realized where his interest lay. "Frustrating," I said. I kept thinking of writers I'd have liked to lock up. Maybe that's how animals in the zoo feel. "You don't mind being the man who holds the keys," Andre replied. I could tell the young man was impressed. In my late middle age, that seldom happens. We had coffee that afternoon at the Café Reggio on MacDougall Street. He was in his mid-30s, looked 5 years younger, had a French mother and an Anglo father, who either was a bit cold and distant, or, as I thought later, wasn't quite cold and distant enough. Andre did freelance design and lived with James, a boring guy, I guessed, who had much more money than Andre and far less imagination than me. Television, radio, the Internet, are wholesale publicity venues. Potentially, you can reach millions. Live readings are retail, not quite one-on-one, though I have done events with not many more readers than that. Just after the Art Zoo, mostly because I live in Manhattan and am available, I was asked to be a last-minute substitute at the monthly New York Review of Science Fiction reading series. The scheduled author, a well-known fantasist and fabled hypochondriac, had come down with something. The reading was at the Melville Gallery on the South Street Seaport. Many years ago, I did my first public reading for that same NYRSF series. Back then, these events were held in a woman's loft on the Bowery. The audience sat around on couches and chairs and bought tea brewed right in the kitchen and cold drinks straight from the fridge. Before that loft event, I hadn't spoken in public for years. I fretted for months, and at the event, read much too softly, some said, while others told me I was much too fast. The other reader, who has gone on to a large career outside the genre, was gracious enough afterwards to forget it had ever happened. In the years since, I've gone from terror to nonchalance, without perhaps ever achieving competence. The South Street Seaport is a small, carefully preserved chunk of old maritime New York. The Melville Gallery on Water Street is a large first-floor space in a vintage building. Pillars hold up the ceiling. At that time, the walls were decorated with paintings of disasters at sea. I'd asked Andre if he wanted to come and listen to me, and since it was early in our acquaintance, he was polite enough to invent a plausible excuse. It wasn't my being a writer that turned him on, but the idea of imprisonment and my desire to do it to others. We had begun getting together once or twice a week. Last-minute substituting wins you the gratitude of the ones running the event, but not necessarily of those who have come to hear someone else. The crowd was good-sized and didn't seem violently disappointed. Again, I saw the small figure with the wise old monkey's face. He was seated among young writers who didn't seem aware of him. Then I got distracted. "Saw you at the zoo the other week," said a large, surly young man who previously had done no more than glower at me. "I'd like to get me some of that publicity. My novel is 1,200 pages long, so big it frightens all those little editors." "Maybe you should do some short fiction," I suggested. "Make them feel warm and safe." "It takes me 20,000 words just to clear my throat," he replied. "How did you get included in the art zoo?" young woman asked. I inquired all over the place as to where I should apply and got no response. "You don't apply," I said. "It's like a real zoo. They catch you with nets." She shook her head and didn't believe me. The other reader that month was Brockman, tall and crane-like. An old-time science fiction writer, Brockman was famous for having blown the fuses in his brains back in the Golden Age while writing too many paperback originals too fast on too much booze and amphetamine. He's bitter and disillusioned. It's his shtick. "I'd never heard of you until I found you were doing this reading," Brockman said, staring down at me. "I read a couple of your stories that got some attention. I thought they were okay." That's as close to a compliment as Brockman gives. I started to thank him, but he was staring at the crowd. "Herzog," he muttered. "You can't keep a dead fraud down. He plagiarized a story of mine for an Outer Limits script." Then I realized who that monkey child was. Kinsey Herzog, legendary speculative fiction writer, winner of everything from the Nebula to the Oscar, and a legendary literary infighter. "Never forgives a slight or a favor," it was said of him. Decades in the genre make one accustomed to this kind of thing. He had died in his late 70s, some years before. Brockman was a master of the feud himself, but that night he was flustered, staring Herzog's way and stammering. From the corner of my eye, I saw the monkey child give a little smile each time that happened. And I seem to recall that it was Herzog who had accused Brockman of plagiarism. When I was introduced by the reading's curator, I walked to the lectern. The wall behind me was lined with oil paintings of sailing ships, capsizing in hurricane winds, trapped in ice, burning to the waterline. "The God of Thieves found himself in a vast hall filled with people rushing about, laden with packages," I began. Looking into the audience, I saw no trace of Kinsey Herzog. The next afternoon, Andre came by my place. His schedule was loose enough that he had chunks of time when no one knew where he was. Retirement made it easy for me to arrange these diversions. We talked for a little while about the art on my walls, and then the game began. "I know your life, my friend," I said. "A rich man indulges you, and you repay him by cheating." He showed surprise that I knew this. "Are you with the police?" he said, looking a bit apprehensive. This evolved into a scenario of his being a young revolutionary in a country not quite like the one we were in. He fell into the hands of an enigmatic older man who stripped and handcuffed him. This improvisation was easy to invent, produced its pleasures, and shortly after it was over, Andre was gone. Early Saturday morning, a couple of weeks later, I went on the radio to promote a story collection that had recently appeared. At 5 a.m., from the southernmost tip of Manhattan, The Hour of the Wolf is broadcast on WBAI. 2 hours of talk, music, and readings, centered on speculative fiction. This venue is a personal favorite of mine, one that exists only at a very odd hour, in a part of the city all but deserted in that particular time. Listener-sponsored WBAI was once the wild child of free-form New York radio, the place to go for coverage of smoke-ins and protest marches. Now, in the pre-dawn, I arrived at an almost empty skyscraper, signed in with security, in a silent lobby, went up to the shabby station, where an engineer and a couple of other guys sat around gossiping. WBAI, as always, was on the verge of some money crisis, a takeover by dissident radicals or unpaid creditors. I got off on the combination of ritual and impending doom. Like every other time I'd been on the air, I wondered if it would be the last. The transition from one show to the next is like the stunt where one kid slides into the driver's seat of a moving car as the driver bumps onto the shotgun side. The car doesn't even lurch. The prior show's host arose, the reggae music theme faded out, my host sat down, and a wolf's howl faded in. It was on radio, undisturbed by a visible audience, that I learned how to read aloud, to utilize the quiet library voice I'd acquired over decades at a reference desk. That morning, I began. Every version of the world that's ever been or will be has a way of dealing with its wild boys and bad girls. The army recruiter, the sweet-talking Ponce, the press gang at the harbor, each takes away his share. The great part of this particular gig came after 2 hours broadcasting to the world from a closed studio. That's when I staggered into the lobby of WBAI and looked out the windows at the dawn on the Silver Hudson River. Books of Wonder in the West Teens, just off Fifth Avenue, has very nice cookies, shelves of children's books, and classic cover art on the walls. They give lots of readings there, and on a Sunday afternoon, between Thanksgiving and Christmas, they held one for the authors of a children's anthology in which I'd appeared. In my time, I've gone out with hustlers, medical students and cops, a messier, a head waiter, and an artist who made electronic sculpture out of dysfunctional picture tubes, but never with another writer or even someone much interested in books. I don't know why, but I again asked Andre if he wanted to hear me read. He shook his head, said he couldn't. This time, I saw he was a little put off by the invitation. That Sunday, in an open space at the backs of Books of Wonder, the audience included more adults than children. The writer, whom everyone calls the Major because of her military bearing, was also in the anthology and was present. The Major was the one who had insisted over my protest that I be locked up in the writer's cage. Even though things had turned out rather well, I resented that. But she nodded to me, and I nodded back. Half a dozen of us read. Each was allotted 10 minutes. Her story was a charming piece of derring-do, in which a resourceful girl rescued her bully of an older brother. Oop. Am I missing part of this story? Hang on 1 second here. No. Sorry. Her bully of an older brother been turned into a frog. She then kept him in an aquarium in her room, fed him flies. This reminded me of how much I'd liked the Major's work back when we were younger and on speaking terms. When I went to tell her that, something had caught her attention. I followed the Major's gaze and saw Kinsey Herzog in the audience, wide-eyed and amused. He was a sad ghost, she said, hanging around old abandoned scenes, places where writers had hung out back when he was alive. We brought him here and to a few other places where writers currently gather. For someone who's dead, he manages to stay very active. When my turn came, I looked out at the audience of smiling adults and serious children, none of whom noticed Herzog, and said, "There was never such a celebration as when the Queen of Summer and the King of Winter wed. The four winds, their mutual cousins, in the excitement of the moment, blew open every door and window in the castle." In my life, many relatives and friends have been painters, photographers. Their work covers the walls of my tiny apartment. Andre, on his next visit, looked them over. He spoke quietly. "Some of these are valuable. Did you purchase them?" "Each was a gift," I said, and looked a little scornful. "Is your art will be when the time comes for me to take it from you." The tit clips I had put on the night table gave just the right effect. For reasons buried in my youth, I like a dash of fear in the sexual mix. Andre's expression showed me that he understood and that the game was on. Housing Works Bookstore lies on the vague frontier where Soho meets the Lower East Side. The store has comfortable chairs and a nice cafe attached. It's run by a foundation that helps the homeless and people with HIV. That January, I took part in a reading there for an anthology of stories about gay elves. Andre, of course, was absent. This venue attracted a glamorous crowd of best-selling YA authors that turned out for one of their number, who was a reader. In my story, a young half-breed describes mortal fay love in the demi-monde. The dollar boys and pillar girls, when they boast about their protectors, lovers, always talk of velvet tongues and...
WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM.
It was a good performance, if I do say so. The audience reaction was strong. A couple of bloggers who covered the event gave my reading very nice reviews. Strangely, I felt bothered that there was no sign of Herzog. There was, however, a woman, elderly and elegant, in a long black dress with tiny silver buckles diagonally across the front. She had a halo of blue hair and small silver glasses through which she peered at me. When I looked again, she had vanished. That gave me a mild chill, which I appreciated. Small doses of fear keep horrible fear at bay. I'd learned that as a kid. I wondered if Andre, like me, had been introduced to the game when he was maybe too young. But he always drew back when I pressed him. "Why do you need to think about something that works?" he asked. The coffee house has a magic place in the legend of the written word. From the time that Johnson and Goldsmith traded quips while Boswell scribbled them down, to the evening Ginsberg recited Howl at the Café Rienzi. Think Coffee is a modern-style coffee house, large and well-lighted. At dozens of tables, young people looked up from their laptops with polite interest as I read. Salome's hand is the hinge, and John the Baptist's head is the hammer, on the door knocker at the Studio Caravaggio. I slammed the brass head held by its brass hair on the door a few times before a spy slot on the iron door opens and closes. The espresso machine came on at that moment and drowned me out, which the audience and I found kind of amusing. Herzog wasn't in the audience, but I did catch sight of the lady in the long black dress. Around then, I began writing a story about a not terribly distant future when the written word is dying away. The narrator, a very self-conscious writer, is involved with a partner who is post-literate and has never read a book. They have little in common but the sex. The sex, however, is quite hot, which turns the narrator on and bothers him a great deal. The partner's name was Andre for the first two drafts when I changed it to Marcel. Our affair had slipped into a routine, and we weren't getting together every week. I wondered how long this would continue. And like the Marceline in the last act of De Rosen Cavalier, I doubted there would be other young men after he was gone. But I had finished the story by the time I gave my next reading. The bar on the second floor of KGB was already jammed when I slipped in the door. A friend waved at me and pointed to an empty chair. I made my way across the worn floor. The crowd at the bar was too deep. A picture of Lenin stared down from the dark red walls. New York has every kind of literary venue, from downtown poetry slams to uptown gatherings of Penn International. But on the third Wednesday of each month, in a red-walled bar, in what was once the left-wing Ukrainian clubhouse on East 4th Street, the right-wingers met at the Ukrainian National Home over on 2nd Avenue, writers, published and unpublished, editors, readers, and critics come to hear speculative fiction authors speak their words aloud. On this particular Wednesday evening, I was one of half a dozen readers at a fundraiser for a campaign for artist co-ops. The owners of a large high-rise apartment building had gone bankrupt in the real estate bubble. A move was afoot to convert the building into low-cost artist housing. The campaign was to make sure space was allocated for destitute spec fiction writers. Anyone who's done enough live readings develops a standing routine. Twitches and quirks can be played for laughs. I once saw a much lauded writer burn a pickle on a stick as a demonstration of some scientific truth in one of his stories. The visual effect was mesmerizing. The smell was disgusting. When I got up to read, there were sirens outside. I said, "The one great thing about getting old is that when I hear that sound, I relax because I know the police are no longer interested in me. Ambulances, however, are another matter." Then I began. Each time he finds me reading, Marcel watches me with a look of concern and distrust, so slight that I would miss it if we hadn't been together for over a year. I glanced around the packed tables, the line of faces at the bar, the people standing a few feet in front of the podium. Andre wasn't there, of course, but Herzog was, and this time, leaning against him, was the woman with the silver glasses and buttons. From across the room, the major gave them a stare that would have frozen any living person's blood. There was a long pause. A couple of people coughed. I shifted my gaze to the text. That night, each time I solicited a sigh, a gulp, a sign of satisfaction, I murmured to Marcel, "I learned that from a book." After KGB readings are over, a large crowd always walks up to St. Mark's Place for dinner. It's in the building erected on the former site of that huge Polish wedding hall, where Warhol, the artist who knew everything about self-promotion, introduced the Velvet Underground to the unwary world. The restaurant is Chinese, and once had a Chairman Mao theme, with menus designed to look like little red books. Unobtrusive traces of that remain and form a strange symmetry with KGB's Soviet decor. On the way there, that night, someone talked about an artist circus in Tompkins Square Park to promote the artist co-op. I happened to walk next to Brockman, the first time we'd met since we read together at South Street. He had spotted Herzog with the thin old lady. "That's Melanie Anselm," he said, "very big in children's fantasy when she was alive. She and Herzog were a big item back when his second wife threw him out of the house." He gave a rusty laugh. "Many years ago, the major had a kid's novel. Everyone thought was going to get the Newbery Medal. But Melanie had connections. Some say she seduced one of the judges and snatched it away from her. The major is still furious about it." We walked in the midst of a crowd of young writers and editors that didn't seem to pay much more attention to us than they did to Herzog and Melanie Anselm. Their talk centered on the circus promotion and how it would be a more positive statement than the zoo. The major walked near us, and from her expression, I thought she might now regret having brought Herzog back among the living. It felt a bit like she and Brockman and I were only slightly removed from the ghosts who tagged along and tried to stay visible for a little while longer. Then one very young lady, editor, turned to us. She had an idea for a lion tamer act with a group of prominent speculative fiction writers as the big cats and wondered what we thought. Brockman snorted. The major looked dubious. But I told her it sounded interesting and wondered what the media coverage would be like.
I happen to like New York. I happen to like this town. I like the city air. I like to drink of it. The more I know New York, the more I think of it. I like the sight and the sound and even the stink of it. I happen to like New York. I like to go to Battery Park and watch those liners booming in. I often ask myself, why should it be that they should come so far from across the sea? I suppose it's because they all agree with me. They happen to like New York. Last Sunday afternoon, I took a trip to Hackensack, but after I gave Hackensack the once over, I took the next train back. I happen to like New York. I happen to love this bird. And when I have to give the world a last farewell, and the undertaker starts to ring my funeral bell, I don't want to go to heaven, don't want to go to hell. I happen to like, I happen to like, I happen to like New York.
else with that, you know, take no prisoners approach to Cole Porter. Whoops. Not time for the outro yet. I had it queued up, but there it is. Okay, so you heard Venues, read for you by the author, Richard Bowes. And I have just been informed that Delphine Blue is here to answer your calls. That is to say, we don't have to pitch to the web. I wasn't prepared for pitching this morning, but here at WBAI, as you heard in the story, we are always, that wasn't fiction, we are always in some form of financial crisis or other, and therefore I am always ready to pitch at the drop of a hat. It is, I only 90 seconds since I've been told that we can do this. And we will. I'm going to ask Rick's forbearance and forgiveness and say yes, we will need to do that for a few minutes, in fact.
Sounds good.
Yeah, and but we will also put aside time to do announcements again to remind people. Oh, yeah, there was another one, speaking of things going under, that I had intended to mention. Realms of Fantasy magazine, edited by Douglas Cohen, who's been on this program, is apparently also in danger. They also need subscribers, and if you want to know more about that time-honored magazine, I guess the best place to go is rofmag.com, Realms of Fantasy magazine. And it's been in the specfic news, so do take a look. So getting back to the fact that we actually have two people to answer phones. Well, make them do so. You know the reasons. You know the rationale. Heck, we could even pull out of the hat premiums if we had to. Oh, and there's Delphine just going by. She just waved at me. But let's just start with the basic. $25 makes you a member of WBAI. When I started working at WBAI, it was $35 and $50. And, well, now it's $25. Go figure. And that's 40 years ago, well over 40 years ago. The rates have gone down, but our need has not lessened at all.
It's increased.
It's increased, yes, exponentially, it yes. would seem. Yes. From being rent-free in a brownstone to needing to rent space on Wall Street, our needs are different now. And it's not just the rent. It's the transmitter room. It's, well, we're I don't know how much in debt. I believe we're actually now under $1 million in debt, at least for WBAI. I can't speak for Pacifica wide, but we need to survive. One phone call is coming in, and I haven't given out the phone number. That's amazing. But thank you. Some people do know it already. 212-209-2950 is the number to call and pledge. $25 will make you a member of WBAI. Now, we have a book. We have a book that Richard Bowes has a short story in that for a $60 pledge, you can receive a copy of The Beastly Bride. We have about five of these. So why not pledge $60? And get a copy of, this is one of Ellen Datlow and Terry Windling's wonderful, what do they call that series, the mythology series?
I don't know what the series is called. It began with The Green Man. It continued with
The Fairy Reel?
The Fairy Reel. Coyote Road was the third one.
And this is the fourth.
Yes.
And I believe there's a fifth forthcoming.
I think there are five in total, as far as the contract is concerned. So, but you can get the fourth, and it's a wonderful. You just look at the table of contents, and you will know if you were listening a couple of weeks ago when Ellen was here. You heard all about it in great details, but now in detail. But now, by utter coincidence, because I didn't even know I would be pitching. Rick Bowes is here. Who? What's the name of the story in the book?
The Margays' Children is my story.
Right.
And there are terrific stuff. There's a Peter Beagle story, The Children of the Shark God, which is has one of the most amazing beginnings. There's a Lucius Shepard story, which is terrific. It's a terrific piece. Yeah. And there are many others. Many
Greg Foss, Nan Fry. She wrote this poem, which she read part of at the McNally Jackson bookstore.
Right.
I loved that. And I'm usually not, you know, that big on poetry, but I loved that.
I liked it so much, I didn't even know it was a poem.
Yeah, same here. I didn't realize. Right, In fact, I was asking my partner doing that. I asked her, you know, why is that a poem and what Rick read is prose? And she said, well, we'll look at the book when we get home. And, oh, yes, there are different line breaks. Interesting.
Right. The poem, it's written all down the middle of the page.
Yes, exactly. One is center justified, sprawl, the other is left justified.
Right, yeah, no, yeah.
But it was wonderful anyway you cut it.
No, it was excellent.
It's a star-studded collection of fabulous, in every sense, fantastic stories.
It's human-animal interaction.
Yeah.
And I had thought, you know, when I heard the thing, well, it means children of, you know, human-animal
interaction. Yes, exactly. Interaction.
But then other people did other things with it that were far more, you know, ingenious.
And I suggested such to Ellen, and she gave me such a nasty look. I can't.
What?
And when I suggested what the beastly interactions might be, I remembered the WBAI parody show, A Walk with the Beast. That was done here in the 70s, and well, you can just imagine.
Yes.
And it was wonderful. Max should have a copy of that. But, as I said, this is not your typical radio station. But it is a radio station that right now, we're getting no calls. Come on, let's get started. I know that you weren't up for this, neither was I, but okay, we need to go into high gear. Let's just, you know, do it. 212-209-2950. And yes, by the way, if you're listening, Delphine, this is a registered premium. We pitched it 2 weeks ago. It's fully registered and all that. It's perfectly kosher. I don't know what the break code is or anything like that, but if you look it up, it'll be there. It's called The Beastly Bride. And that's yours in thanks for a $60 pledge to WBAI. A $25 pledge will make you a member to WBAI. One person is currently calling up. Thank you very much. Let's get a few more. 212-209-2950. The sad, sad truth is you can use logic. You can use compelling emotions. You can use whatever it is that you want. But the only thing that gets people to call is reciting the phone number. That's it. 212-209-2950. Call now. That or a bludgeon, you know. 212.
Threats.
Threats, exactly.
Threats, yeah.
Yeah. And even then, certain threats don't work. But saying the phone number, 212-209-2950 is the number to call. One person is currently calling to pledge. We have only a few minutes in which to do this because, well, it came out of the blue, but if you call now, you will reach Delphine Blue. How about that? 212-209-2950. And she does one of the best shows in New York radio. I mean, you love music shows, you listen to her. 212-209-2950 is the number to call. Please call now. Pledge your support. Show that you care about the arts here on WBAI. That to me, it's not just about my show or whatever. We have this block here of literary arts between myself and Simon Lokley, and with Delphine answering the phone, one of the best music shows here. Chris Wendt with Hear of a Sunday Morning on Sunday mornings, Opera Glass, Through the Opera Glass. There are a few great art shows left, Cat Radio Cafe, on this program, on the station. We need to show management that arts programming is something that you treasure. Arts programming is something that you want. Arts programming is something that you support. Support it by calling now. Tell the people here that, yes, it's essential to have the political programs that we have. It's essential to keep that free voice. But one of the most important free voices that exist is the voice of the artist. And that can be done only if we tell management with your hard-earned dollars that arts programming is something that you support, that you want. Money really does talk, even here at listener-sponsored radio, perhaps especially here. Yes, yes, especially here at listener-sponsored radio. 212-209-2950 is the number to call to pledge your support, to show support for WBAI, for the arts, and for Hour of the Wolf. 212-209-2950. One call still coming in. Let's make it a couple more. We have 4 minutes left. And in that 4 minutes also, I wish to outro theme, that's why. In those 4 minutes, we need to mention a couple of things about Rick, mention what's coming up on the program, stuff like that. It's the last day of the fundraising drive, okay? Last chance, not this year, but last chance, this thon, until the next fundraising drive comes up. What's it, next week, Simon?
I think it's we got 2 weeks off.
Oh, okay, yes, exactly. 212-209-2950. The more you pledge, the fewer drives we have in the long run. Rick says, no, if only that were true. Two calls coming in. Thank you very much. Please call now, pledge now. 212-209-2950 is the number. We only have two people answering phones, so let's get 5 calls right now, okay? Let's make them work for the salary that they don't receive, being volunteers primarily. 212-209-2950. Ooh, okay. Two calls went away and another call appeared. That's very interesting. But let's get some action going. Let's get some calls in. $25 will make you a member of WBAI, and $60, we will say thank you in return for your pledge with a copy of The Beastly Bride, with which our guest this morning, Rick Bowes, has contributed to, edited by Terry Wendling and Ellen Datlow. It's like 400 and something pages, as I recall.
It's a big book, yes.
Yeah. It,
full of human-animal interaction.
Yes, what more can you possibly want? What more can beg the imagination?
Really, once you have that, you don't need another book.
Indeed. It is the last book you'll... And never mind. 212-209-2950 is the number to call and pledge. Please make that pledge now. And $60 pledge would be just magnificent, really wonderful. And we will return that. We only have 5 copies of the book. We haven't gotten 5 phone calls, so I know that there are still a few left. So make that call now. Make that pledge now. And if we have to get more, we will, but that shouldn't be necessary. That's a live mic, guys. 212-209-2950 is the number to call and pledge. 212-209-2950. $25 for a normal subscription to WBAI and $60 for
an abnormal subscription.
Exactly.
Yes.
And abnormally, we will send you a copy of The Beastly Bride. 212-209-2950. And we do appreciate your calls and your pledges. And it is a fabulous anthology. You heard some of Rick's writing read to you live this morning. And I really liked the story in there. And I liked the reading that you did last week.
Of the Margays children.
Of the Margays children. I didn't know quite what you were going to say. But, okay, we have, 2.5 minutes. 2.5 minutes. Simon is plugging in stuff. Oh, my God. 212-209-2950 is the number to call. And let's see. I do have to make announcements. Our guest next week, Alaya Dawn Johnson, but we will not be pitching. So you have to say thank you now. in order to do that. At KGB this week, if that story Venues that Rick read earlier inspires you to attend these kinds of readings, Jack Ketchum and Scott Edelman, a reading of horrors at KGB coming Wednesday. And for more information about that, you can go to kgbfantasticfiction.org. But right now, let's see. No calls are coming in right now, and we have 90 seconds of pitching time left. So let's have a flurry, nay, a blizzard of phone calls to close out the morning. 212-209-2950. Frankly, we haven't done all that well begging for money on this program, this particular thon, this particular fundraising drive, and it would be nice to make a dent, to show people that even on the spot, on the spur of the moment, we can make a difference. And you can make a difference right now by showing what's going on. 1 minute left. 212-209-2950 is the number to call. 212-209-2950. And here comes Delphine. She's walking fast, so it's with a purpose. What is that purpose, Delphine? We have pledges. I can read these?
Yeah.
Jackson Tech, thank you so much, from Rockaway. And as well, oh my God, Bertie O'Geary, who I just had. I think I had email correspondence. It may have been somebody else.
She said that she loves you.
Oh, my God.
It says it at the bottom, I think.
Oh, it does. It does. It says, Jim, I absolutely adore you. Oh. Wow. Thank you so much. And those are both nice pledges. Thank you so much. $25 and $60. So thank you, Delphine. I didn't even know I was going to be pitching this morning. Great to see you.
Great to see you too.
I have to talk to you when I get out. I love the shirt. Can everybody on the radio see this very faux 60s Sergeant Pepper's kind of?
Can this guy talk or what?
yeah, especially when I'm out of time. 212-209-2950. Thank you all. Rick, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, always appreciated. I mean, you've been here, you know, within the last year, but this time, but
ever?
Not on,
was that within the last year?
I'm sure Dadlow dragged you. Yes, but usually you're here as like in the story. Oh, I've got no. That's an aspect you didn't have. I've got an anthology coming out. Let's bring Rick to read from it. Because you're in all those books. It was time that you were here on your own.
As a human being.
Yes. Indeed. The theme has started. It is quietly in the background. Stay tuned for As I Please with Simon Locally on Wednesday. Celebrate Bloomsday by going to a horror reading at the KGB Fantastic Fiction. There you go. Simon approves. And he'll tell you all about Stand-Up Academy this month. I'll be back next week with Elia Dawn Johnson. Follow my Twitter feeds, Facebook, all that kind of junk. And still not too late to make a phone call to pledge to WBAI. Have a good morning. Thank you again, Rick Bowes, B-O-W-E-S. Yes. That's so you can Google it and get all his books, which there are.
Of which there are a few. Yes.
Yes, indeed. Thanks again. Good morning.
Set my sails of silver.
And you are tuned to WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. And good morning, and hello, and welcome once again to As I Please for this, the 12th day of June in the year 10. And did you note the astonishing development printed on the front page of the New York Times this week? The world's oldest shoe has been discovered. And as we know, civilization took its first step when the fledgling human being said, "I'm gonna put something on my foot." And this shoe is dated at something like over 5,000 years old. It is provided with laces and a fine Cuban heel, which is amazing because this shoe was found in Armenia. Ooh, far, far away in Armenia. This, the oldest shoe known to man or woman. And of course, what is astonishing about this, what has kept me up tossing and turning, just thinking of the way that history works, by an extraordinary coincidence, the kind that only exists in Hollywood, my cobbler is himself Armenian. Boom, 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 boom. There's something to think about. And speaking of thinking about, is that number one? Well, we'll give it a try. Yes, it is. One is not master of one's moods. All morning long, I have been feeling remarkably chipper. I don't know why, and I'm not going to investigate further, although I should say that perhaps the spring in my step was due to the fact that I knew that when I came in this morning, I would be able to do a program without the relentless and ceaseless nagging, for you to dial phone and make a pledge of support to this radio station, because according to official word, the ton was over. Or rather, suspended for this moment. But, you know, things change, and it is a testament to the arts of live radio that you go with the flow. And so, not very long ago, perhaps 37 minutes ago, there arrived at WBAI two intelligent, and I might add gorgeous women, who are ready to answer phones here at WBAI to get whatever little you can afford for this wacky and wild radio station. And so I'm more than happy to say, as long as they're here, let's keep them busy. And I will also say that this may be an opportunity for you to register your perspective, your point of view. Those of you who, for better or for worser, for reasons that perhaps you cannot possibly fathom, and yet, nevertheless, 'tis a habit that you have succumbed to, and that is Saturday morning, reaching over, turning on the radio. Oh, maybe you start early, but certainly you're trying to be somewhere near a radio at 7 o'clock. Why? For this stinking, lousy, amateurish program known as I Please. And so last week you tuned in, because that's the habit, only to discover a rebroadcast on some odd topic that, well, just didn't relate to the issues, to the things that you hunger for. Well, is that how it is, comrades? Are you still miffed at the bizarre and really unsubstantiated cancellations in order to bring you boring rebroadcasts? Now is your chance to protest. To protest with a phone call to the phone, and yet a useful protest. Not the typical WBAI protest, which says, "You people are terrible, and I'm never going to listen to you again." I remember there's a guy who now works at WNYC who once told me, now, I don't know why he felt that he had to tell me this, but he once told me that I will never listen to WBAI again.